We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in baseball isn't boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thank you for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. The U.S. has been pulling back from the Middle East during Donald Trump's 4 years in the White House, and considering how U.S. policy in the region has gone since the heady days of kicking Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, it may be understandable. But is retrenchment the correct course for the U.S.? We're joined by Stephen Cook, who thinks pulling back from the Middle East is the wrong move for the U.S., as he outlines in his article in Foreign Affairs, titled No Exit: Why the Middle East Still Matters to America. Stephen is an Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, good to have you back on The Crisis Next Door.
It's great to be with you, Jason.
Stephen, the last time we chatted on the podcast was 1 year ago, before the pandemic swept across the world. While that has had a chilling effect on many facets of life around the globe, the one thing that has not changed has been the continual struggle for supremacy in the Middle East, with warring sides continuing to slug it out in Syria, Yemen, and Libya. Now, as you point out in your foreign affairs piece, No Exit, the U.S. has had a dismal record over the past two decades in the Middle East. How is that shaping current U.S. policy decisions toward the region?
It's a great question, Jason, and it's really the question that is occupying the time of many Middle East analysts in Washington and beyond. The last two decades, certainly since the invasion of Iraq, the United States has confronted, two wars that have been dragged on for a long time, continuation of the extremist threat, no resolution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. No country in the Middle East has become more democratic as a result of U.S. efforts. And in fact, when you look across the region, it is more unstable than it has ever been in recent memory. Not all of that is the U.S.'s fault, but there is a question that is at the heart of our current foreign policy debates, which is, does the United States still need to be in the Middle East? What interests are being served by being in the Middle East? And would the Middle East be better served by an American withdrawal from the region? There is, given our track record over the last few years, a consensus has formed about in leaving the region in some way. The article that you were nice enough to mention is a response to those arguments.
What would you say America's vital interests are in the Middle East?
Well, traditionally, our vital interests in the Middle East have been the free flow of energy resources out of the region, helping to ensure Israeli security and maintaining American dominance in the region so that no single state or group of states could challenge either of those two other interests. And then, of course, add to that counterterrorism and counterproliferation, which all of those things, Americans over a long period of time have demonstrated their willingness to invest in, defend, and sacrifice for. I think the question that people are asking is, are those interests as important to us as they once were? And in fact, in the article, I say is that they may no longer be as critical as they once were. The United States is independent when it comes to oil production. Israel's security is now beyond a doubt. So that there are changes that could be made to American policy in the Middle East. But withdrawing from the region is actually a risky prospect and actually may make things more unstable.
You mentioned the fact that the U.S. has been really pumping out a lot of oil to become energy independent. And of course, there is the wider move towards clean energy, but still a lot of need for oil. And a real surprising situation a year ago when the oil facilities in Saudi Arabia were attacked and most fingers of blame were pointing at Tehran, yet nothing happened. On the one hand, a major war was averted, but on the other, it seemed to defang the U.S. and its longtime mission to protect Middle Eastern oil fields. How do you think that affects Iran's view of the U.S. and its ability to act with impunity in the region?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the bombing of the Khurais and Abqaiq oil facilities in Saudi Arabia came after a long and difficult summer in the Persian Gulf, in which the Iranians affixed mines to oil tankers, took two other oil tankers hostage for a while, shot down an American surveillance drone over the Persian Gulf, and then, as I said, took this dramatic action of taking 50% of the world's oil supply off the market, albeit temporarily, but this was rather dramatic. And the Trump administration's response ran counter to four decades of declared U.S. policy that that an attack on the Middle Eastern oil facilities and navigation in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz and that area would be met with a commensurate military response. The United States didn't do that, raising questions about whether, and not only did it not do it, but it didn't do it with the approval of the American foreign policy community across the political spectrum, which raises, which for me was a data point suggesting that the United States will in time end up leaving the region. Now, you know, I can make an argument that even though the United States has become independent of, has become the world's largest producer of oil, that the United States still needs to stay in the Persian Gulf and to protect the sea lanes for the health of the global economy. But it's politically appealing in the United States to talk about energy independence. And thus, if the United States is energy independent, the United States doesn't need to be in the Middle East. But until the economy, as you suggest, until the global economy is decarbonized, oil and fossil fuels are going to be very, very important.
Do you think a Biden White House will look upon the Middle East differently than Trump has done in his 4 years?
Oh, undoubtedly. I think that the Biden administration will look to reengage with the Iranians. We'll take a much harder line with regional leaders who have terrible human rights records. Those are countries that the president has essentially given a pass in his broader goal to apply maximum pressure on the Iranians. Maximum pressure, you know, another debate that we have in Washington is whether maximum pressure works. There's really no evidence that the president's policy with regard to Iran has worked very much other than to make life very difficult for millions of Iranians. The Iranians continue to play a malevolent role around the region. They have they are closer to their goal of developing nuclear technology than they had before and are, in fact, engaged in a program to build a new nuclear facility. So it strikes me that a Biden administration will see diplomacy as the best way to move Iran away from this goal. My own sense is that a second Trump administration continuing maximum pressure and talking about regime change radicalizes the region in one way. Yet a new nuclear agreement and diplomatic outreach to Iran radicalizes the region in another way. That's to say, when you talk about maximum pressure and regime change in Iran, the Iranians lash out across the region to demonstrate that they have the ability to respond and make life miserable for America, for the United States and its allies. When we talk about a new nuclear agreement, opponents in the region of that nuclear agreement, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, those three countries in particular, but others as well, will use all the resources available at their disposal to try to undermine that agreement. So in the Foreign Affairs article that you mentioned, what I say is that it's the most realistic and realizable policy with regard to Iran is actually one that is based on containment, that we contain the Iranians, we contain their adventurous foreign policy around the region, while at the same time trying to deny them the components of the nuclear program that they are developing.
There's been a lot of talk over the past decade about the so-called Shiite crescent extending from Iran through Syria and Iraq and into Lebanon. Has that been overstated? Has that not gone as well as Iran might have hoped due to Israel's moves in the region and countering it in Syria?
Well, certainly, I think that the idea of a Shia crescent expressed in sectarian terms has really been overstated. But the Iranians do have a goal, and their goal is to extend their influence throughout the region. And one thing that the Israelis have done, particularly in Syria, but they've also extended into Iraq, is to try to deny the Iranians the ability to establish themselves in a permanent way in Syria. And they've basically been fighting an undeclared war against Iranian and Iranian-backed forces in Syria. And the Iranians have demonstrated that they really don't have any kind of effective response to the Israelis in Syria, which have really had their way. Every time the Israelis detect something going on in Syria or Iraq with regard to Iran or its proxies, the Israelis take action, and the Iranians have not been able to respond in kind.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're joined by Stephen Cook, author of an article in Foreign Affairs titled No Exit: Why the Middle East Still Matters to America. Russia has gone the opposite way of the U.S. and is invested heavily into Syria, Libya, and elsewhere. And China is making more noise in the Middle East with a 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership agreement reached this year with Iran, and China investing hundreds of billions of dollars into Iranian infrastructure. Should the U.S. be worried about Russia and China in the Middle East?
Well, certainly the Russians and the Chinese, the Russians are back in the Middle East. Their intervention in Syria, whether leaders in the region like Bashar al-Assad or not, demonstrated, however, that the Russians would stand by their longtime allies. In contrast, from their perspective, to the United States, which, after a short period of time of protests against Egypt's Hosni Mubarak, backed away from Mubarak and demanded that he leave office. And that's the distinction. And so it has given the Russians a fair amount of influence in the region that they have extended beyond Syria to other places. The Russians have portrayed themselves as non-ideological, competent, and ready to lead, and they have capitalized on American mistakes over the course of the last few decades. But of course, you know, the Russians, for all that they have done in Syria, and for all that they have portrayed themselves as ready to lead, and the receptivity from some countries in the region to their exercise of power in the region, really can't compare in terms of the United States, in terms of America's security and defense assistance that it can provide to countries of the region. China is very interesting in that, you know, it has made this a big move in Iran, but it has made a big move everywhere. It has, over the course of the last few decades, upgraded its relations with Saudi Arabia, with the United Arab Emirates, with Egypt, with Algeria, with Morocco. These are all countries that are partners of the United States. And this is part of China's much ballyhooed Belt and Road Initiative, which is, depending on who you talk to, either something that is designed to facilitate China's continued rise as an economic power, or it is that plus China's effort to supplant the United States in terms of the country that provides stability and order in global governance. Either way, it's clear that the Chinese are in the region. They have invested heavily in the region, but even so, they once again don't compare to what the United States can provide these countries in terms of security and defense assistance. And for all of the Chinese investment in places in North Africa, for example, it really pales in comparison to the kind of investment that the Europeans, for example, have made in that part of the region.
Russia and Turkey have found themselves on opposite sides in Syria and Yemen. Turkey, of course, a NATO member, but its relationship with the U.S. has seemed anything but that of an ally. How big of a thorn is Ankara in Washington's side in Middle East affairs?
Oh, it's a big thorn in Washington's side. You're right. Turkey is a NATO ally, but it's not exactly a partner. And there are a variety of issues on which the United States and Turkey just do not agree. And the Turks have pursued their national interests independent of America's wishes. And the list is rather long, but you can start with the Turks facilitating the Iranian effort to get around UN sanctions. The Turks complicating the American effort to fight the Islamic State in Syria. Turkish violation, routine violation of Iraqi sovereignty. You can point to Turkey's support for Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement. Its efforts to delegitimize the government of Abdel Fattah Sisi in Egypt. Sisi came to power through a coup in 2013, but the United States has decided to recognize that government, whereas the Turks have not. And Egypt is important to the United States. So there are a long list of issues on which the two countries are divided, and there doesn't seem to be a way in which the United States can pull the Turks back. They just see the region differently. They have different goals and different priorities, and as I said, are intent on pursuing their interests independent of the United States.
Iraq, of course, is the grim reminder of America's current failures in the Middle East. Is it possible for the U.S. to remove itself from Iraq without an even worse calamity laying in wait for the country?
It's an interesting question, and I think the answer is no. I think one of the stunning ironies or upside down logics of our misadventure in Iraq is that if we want to get out of Iraq, we're going to have to stay a while longer. We already have withdrawn a considerable amount of force from Iraq. There's only about 5,000 American service members in the country now on a very specific training mission for and with the Iraqi security services in terms of counterterrorism and just kind of increasing the ability of the Iraqi military to operate and to defend the country's sovereignty. Iraqi sovereignty is contested by a number of different countries, including Turkey, including Iran. And of course, you do have the American presence there, which also raises questions about Iraq's sovereignty. But I'm afraid that if we left before the Iraqis were more competent in the counterterrorism mission, as well as defending their own sovereignty, things might get worse. We already had a taste of that when the United States withdrew from Iraq in 2011, only to have to to go back a few years later after ISIS overran Mosul and other places in Iraq. It hasn't been much in the news recently, but of course, ISIS and other extremist groups remain a threat in Iraq, as is in other parts of the region.
Stephen, do you see that the fight against Islamic jihadist group would be severely threatened with the U.S. pulling back? I mean, that seems to have been one of the main facets of U.S. policy in the Middle East over the past two decades, has been rooting out Islamic jihadists in the Middle East.
That is an important part of the mission, and I think there's an argument to be made, in fairness, that if the United States leaves, extremists would not be able to use the American presence as a mechanism of mobilization for people to follow them and carry out acts of terrorism. But really, the American presence is one factor in a complicated set of factors that leads to this phenomenon. And I think that these groups, particularly in places like Iraq, where government authority is limited in a lot of places, without the kind of help from the United States, these groups will not feel the pressure. They'll be able to thrive and return once again, not just to threaten the Iraqi government or other governments in the region, but potentially governments in Europe. Just had an attack in France. I think it is premature to declare that our fight against extremism is over. I think we need to do it differently. We need to do a better job of it. There are aspects of what we have done over the course of the last two decades that have been counterproductive in that fight. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't learn from those two decades and continue to meet the threat of extremism.
It will be fascinating to see where the U.S.'s long and oftentimes conflicted relationship goes with the Middle East in the coming years. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us again here on The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We've been joined by Stephen Cook, an Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.